Hey, optimists. They've let me out, and they've given me a roving recorder. Perhaps I lamented a missed career in journalism too soon. I'm delighted that this episode reports live from the field at the Biz for Biz Sustainability Conference. After 2 years of restrictions on events due to the COVID-19 pandemic, in which online events became commonplace, it was great to be able to get back out into an auditorium and feel the palpable buzz of anticipation in a diverse audience who've travelled with a purpose to an in-person event. And what better topic to galvanise delegates around than sustainability and the considerations of best practice ESG agenda for businesses to address their environmental, social and governance obligations. With a roster of 12 keynote speakers assembled from across local and national government, finance, accounting, education, consulting, community engagement and supply chain management, attendees were treated to some amazing insights into the challenges and their potential solution. I was fortunate to be able to interview them all and capture their thoughts fresh from their respective presentations. Wish you were there, but if you weren't, then hopefully this episode will be the next best thing. Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Chief Executive Optimist podcast, exploring conscious capitalism and inclusive leadership and helping you high performers to preserve your sanity and humanity in this time of relentless change. I'm Gareth Hawkins, scale-up coach, investor and principal consultant at Enterprise Insights in London. Today I'm reporting from the Biz for Biz Sustainability Conference at the Rothamsted Institute of Agricultural Research near St Albans in Hertfordshire. The event, which took place refreshingly in person on the 3rd of March and was very well attended, had an amazing lineup of keynote speakers on topics across the ESG spectrum. A key focus for business at present, particularly those PLCs and large companies employing 250 staff or more, who must report their energy use and carbon emissions every year, is carbon reduction. And so, the path to net zero was an important part of the conference agenda, helping companies of all sizes understand how to make the transition and pursue a net zero strategy. Following the welcome and opening of the conference, the first keynote was given by BMF Alami MP, in whose Hitchin and Harpenden constituency the Rothamsted Institute resides. Ben was a recent guest on this podcast in episode 10, and he gave us the government's perspective in his keynote, after which I caught up with him and asked him to summarise the main points from his thought-provoking speech. I asked him, looking ahead, what could sustainability mean for the UK economy? And in this VUCA paradigm, post-Brexit, post-pandemic and now with the war in Ukraine, what are the key tangible forces and their effects on the drive towards sustainability?
People should think about security and the need for sustainability, meaning local British energy generation in this country. They should think about growth and the future opportunities that are going to come from sustainability, because this is where the zeitgeist is. This is what people are talking about. This is what your consumers are going to want. And I'd also think about energy and energy efficiency, because the events in Ukraine are just another reminder that being exposed to sort of fossil fuels from unstable parts of the world is not a good thing for our energy prices. Energy usage is going to be really, really important.
From the regional government perspective, Richard Roberts, leader of the Hertfordshire County Council and chair of the Hertfordshire Growth Board, gave us a speech around Hertfordshire's commitment to sustainability. And I managed to speak with him after his speech, in which I asked him, what does HCC's commitment to carbon reduction look like and what does it mean for the region? We discussed how important collaboration is in the sustainability agenda for Hertfordshire and what role the Growth Board plays in that. And as a council responsible for placemaking and infrastructure, where did Richard see the ESG priorities and to what effect?
So we are committed to be carbon zero as an organisation by 2030. And during that time, we'd also want to influence those around us, both our suppliers, but also our fellow district and borough councils. Hugely important because it brings together a business, but also local government. We are going to have to work really closely together on this. And I think one of the areas where I am delighted that to make as much progress as possible is around development. Our residents of 1.2 million demand that we build sustainably. We need to have the highest possible standards in this special place called Hertfordshire. I want us to build the communities of the future, which are linked both physically, footpaths, cycleways, and also digitally. a sustainable communication network right across Hertfordshire from Hemel Hempstead to Harlow, and so that we have our residents and our businesses and our communities, the experiences and the natural environment, which is so special in Hertfordshire, all pulled together. The Growth Board is going to be essential in driving the agenda towards sustainable development. And the Climate Change Partnership is also really important in ensuring that we improve our biodiversity, that we clean our air, that we value the water we drink that flows through our chalk streams, so that we get the maximum benefit for our residents, both existing and, of course, that 100, 150,000 who will come to Hertfordshire in the next 15 years.
Barclays Bank were one of the main sponsors of the event, and in attendance were Stephen Ainsworth, Head of Eastern Region, and Marco De Benedictis, Head of Sustainable Finance, who both gave really insightful speeches from the perspective of finance. I caught up with them both and asked them for their thoughts on why Barclays clients are typically pursuing a sustainable agenda.
There are many reasons that businesses adopt sustainable practices. There are some businesses that whose business is sustainable, so recycling businesses, for instance, energy production businesses, you know, wind farms and such. But then there are many other businesses that are adopting sustainability practices just because they believe it's the right thing to do. And then there are other businesses that are adopting it because their customers want them to. So many businesses that are, you know, many small businesses are in supply chains to larger businesses who themselves put requirements on them, but also businesses that deal directly with consumers are hearing the message loud and clear from consumers that consumers want sustainability to be built in.
What are some of the financial considerations right now of investing in sustainability?
Sustainability and ESG and net zero as ambitions for businesses must also be tied with the sustainable cash flows that businesses want to generate and must generate to survive. We can't just view ESG and net zero in isolation. It's got to be something that fits with businesses' priorities. At the moment, businesses are under enormous strain from COVID, from Brexit, from supply chain issues, from hiking energy prices, and now obviously the impact of Ukraine. So we recognise all those factors impact on a business while the business is trying to be sustainable in the ESG sense as well. So we're here to help with that.
How does it require a change in mindset amongst financiers towards capital funding?
The key thing that I would take away if I was looking to make an investment in something that is sustainable is really to start having that discussion with your banker as soon as you can and understand what alternatives are out there, because there is an expectation that we are going to be facing some cost in the short term. But we've got to think about this cost as an investment into a better product, a better plant, or a better project. The way that we like to look at it is definitely taking that long-term view. And in the future, you know, ideally, there are so many other tangible benefits that you can get from doing something that is sustainable. On our side, it's definitely important. That's why I'm here today and really delighted to be able to speak to people on this agenda.
And with instruments such as social impact bonds and green finance rising in favour as sources of capital for sustainability goals, how has Barclays embraced these?
We are leaders in the sustainability linked and social bond space. We have a capital markets team that is focusing primarily on green and sustainability linked facilities and bonds. So absolutely, that's what we do. We do have many, many professionals internally that are focusing 100% of their time on sustainability and what can be done for the future.
And how does a company build an initial business case to set out to become sustainable?
Have a conversation with your clients, have a conversation with your suppliers. Just ask whether ESG or sustainability or green or climate is important to them. And I think you'll very quickly manage to build those anecdotes and those stories about what it means to your business and what can be the push and the pull factors.
Next up was Richard Whitehead, Chair of Hearts Innovation Quarter, on growing Hertfordshire's green economy and supporting businesses in their transition to net zero. I asked Richard, what is the role of innovation in the journey to achieving net zero? What is the remit of Hearts IQ in helping to drive sustainability in the region?
Innovation is an important part of how we deliver net zero. Innovation in construction materials, the innovation in digital tools, We are here to help existing businesses transition through to net zero. So it's helping with advice, access to funding, and support to help them transition their business to net zero, to green their business, to work in a more sustainable way. We're also attracting new companies into Hertfordshire who are sustainable companies, so clean growth companies, so around sustainable agriculture, around sustainable construction, to bring businesses into Hertfordshire and to grow the green economy here.
And just what types of new facilities are being provided as parts of the Hertfordshire Innovation Quarter?
But there's five sites just off Junction 8 of the M1 near Hemel Hempstead, as well as the BRE and Rothamsted campuses. We're tasked with creating 3 million square feet of new commercial space to accommodate business. We are focusing on into grow on space, so you know, small companies that start up here in Rothamsted or BRE, then they need to leave to go into grow on space. We see that as a real opportunity for RTIQ, so to take those startups and then provide grow on space for them.
The University of Hertfordshire is a key institution in the region. And as Monica Canwar puts it, in order to talk the talk and provide education on sustainability to businesses, they must also walk the walk. As a case study for a large, complex organisation in getting to grips with their own sustainability obligations, I asked her what approach they have taken.
What we've tried to do is actually build on good, solid foundations using our ISO 14001 management standard. And what we've done from that is to make sure that we embed sustainability throughout the organisation, using the key skills of all of our teams across the organisation, using our academics to actually sort of promote what they do, but also making sure our estate acts as a clear example of how we walk the walk. Also, what we're acutely aware of as an organisation is that we have a responsibility to make sure that our staff and students understand their role and the importance that the university has as an anchor institute. So over the last year, we've focused on carbon literacy to our staff, and we're hoping to roll that out more so in our student population.
And I asked Yanina Aubrey-Jimenez how the university is supporting businesses and other organisations of various sizes and ages in themselves becoming more sustainable.
We really want organisations to call on us to tap into our research. We have lots of really relevant, interesting, cutting-edge research in areas that are relevant to sustainability, from sustainable transport to low-carbon new construction materials, to new technologies aligned to renewables, to energy storage, and so on and so forth. And we want to make that available to businesses, large and small. And so for early stage businesses, we have our incubator support. It's a 12-month program. What we hope is that they all leave with some element of a sustainability strategy. We recently launched a sustainability accelerator, as you're aware, which is a next stage. It's for businesses that are ready to scale up. Beyond that, we have knowledge transfer partnerships. We have bespoke workforce development packages for larger organizations. Smaller businesses can access a number of free events and training workshops, etc., that we run within the incubator. But for larger businesses, we tend to do sort of more bespoke packages that suit their workforce. We don't only work with businesses, we also work with third sector organisations, large public sector organisations like the NHS, for example. So we are working across the board.
After an insightful morning session, I caught up at lunchtime with Darren Eisted, editor of the Biz for Biz Insight magazine. He gave me his reflections at midday on the societal and macroeconomic drivers for the topics being presented and discussed at the conference.
It's been fantastic to see everyone gathering here at Rothamsted. It's a really good crowd. It's really important for people to network, first and foremost. I think there's a lot of people now coming back after the pandemic. There's a lot of things to discuss with regards to sustainability. That's happening. And obviously, we've had some great speeches already. And there's a real message getting out there and a real thirst for people to have the knowledge as well. So fantastic start to the conference.
And of course, ESG encompasses more than just environmental considerations like carbon reduction, as is evident in the UN's 17 Sustainable Development Goals. It is important that businesses also take steps to improve their social impact and look at their governance to ensure they are doing all they can to drive best practice in their workforce and their supply chains commensurate with these goals. Phil Webb, founder of Investors in Community, a platform that connects charities and contributors and companies, gave us a great presentation on galvanising a team through social value. And afterwards, I caught up with him and asked him how he defines social value and what benefits can improved social impacts have on companies.
First of all, how would I describe social value? It is an espousement of the personal values of the collective company. It's really important because ultimately, post-pandemic particularly, social value has become a buying trigger for many customers. So there's a real commercial driver for this. But more than that, social value is a shared collective value of the staff members, as I said. Staff like to stick around with companies who have good values and talk about them and actually authentically deliver against them. We often see productivity rising, we see retention, we see people working in a different way because they enjoy what they do because they're part of the right company doing the right thing.
Businesses have so many stakeholders across their community. How does taking a deliberate altruistic approach to investing in the community benefit all these groups?
So sustainability, if you look at the various aspects of a business that are affected by social value, number one, your brand. Your brand is judged because it's visible to everybody at all times. Number two, your staff, your teams. They join you, they stick around, they're more productive, they're more loyal to you if you espouse similar values to them, and they can get on board with the fact you're trying to do good in the world like they want to do, but you're doing it in the workplace. Your customers and the consumers, they buy from people and the supply chains are being audited to ensure that social value is part of the makeup of your business, not tagged onto the outside, but a fundamental part, the tree trunk, if you like, around which your business is built and delivered. And all of these things come together, and if you put them all together, that's a sustainable business. We're sandboxing the FCA at the moment, and they're talking about banks offering what we call social value related debt instruments, which means that they may give you a discount on your business loan if you can demonstrate satisfactorily your social value.
And beyond the commercial benefits to a business, are there financial incentives on the horizon for individuals, for example, in a workforce, whose engagement is absolutely essential in community activity?
If you want to try and get ahead in life and promote your business heads and shoulders above that of your competitors, adopt early, deliver early, and publish. And that publishing will do two things. Your internal staff will understand this is a concept that is real, it's authentic, and you're actually doing it. Secondly, the social media posts that you're actually going to be putting out to espouse your values and your results and the impact that you've had on the community around you will probably feel the sense of pride from your staff.
We also heard from Leon Reed, CEO of Verizio, a provider of supply chain management software and services, on de-risking the supply chain through good governance.
Today we've seen our company still managing supply chains on Excel spreadsheets, which isn't a useful tool. Our platform's called Optimus. It's actually in its fourth generation, so it's been around for a long time. The platform has been developed to manage audits and supply chain and risk. The platform actually gives very great visualizations of where a company might start their journey. So you could have a journey at a business critical or high risk process, and it shows the journey in which that factory has taken or the supplier has taken, hopefully right down to the low risk, and also what they've done to get to that point.
Afterwards, we discussed how auditing a supply chain to ensure good governance, anti-corruption, anti-child labour or anti-slave labour can sound to the uninitiated like a hugely data-intensive activity. I asked Leon how this has historically been managed and how that's changing. Technology can clearly alleviate a lot of the manual administration obligations that come with proper supply chain auditing, but what are the main advantages that Verizio's customers see?
One of the things we realised at the very foundations of creating software is that how easy is it to do those processes. So we've actually designed our platform to be very intelligent but very intuitive. But actually to get companies to switch from Excel spreadsheets onto platforms where they have more knowledge can be somewhat challenging. And actually it's the opposite. It should be giving them the focus they need to do their job properly.
Getting back onto the topic of the financial considerations that a sustainability agenda can create for a business, we heard from Mark Pashley, corporate tax partner at Mercer and Hull Chartered Accountants. He explained that there are ways that the UK government has incentivised companies to invest in becoming sustainable, and I asked him what implications these have for the day-to-day financial management of companies.
I think ultimately it's just about tax cash flow. But I think also there are allowances that you can benefit from that reduces your tax liability that then reflects in your lower tax charge in your accounts and that ultimately then gives you more distributable profits and cash as a result.
And so just what are some of these green spending incentives?
it's all consistent with that green agenda. So yeah, whether it's capital allowances, whether it's R&D tax credits, the tax system is trying to basically subsidise businesses' expenditure and time and efforts in pursuing a green agenda.
And how can the support of a good accountancy and tax advisory practice help companies in optimising the effect of a sustainable agenda on their own bottom lines?
These decisions make sense on their own merits as it is. It's just that we can kind of enhance the benefit from a tax and cash perspective by planning early and taking the right advice. Understanding what's around the corner is massive, because you can commit yourself today to expenditure that lasts for the next few years without understanding the significance of that commercially. And the tax agenda should absolutely follow that and dovetail it completely.
Companies can rarely tackle their sustainability obligations alone, and often they seek to engage external specialist consultants to help create and manage their compliance roadmaps. This work can be best summarised as the three A's: auditing, accreditation and advice. We heard from several providers of these services who gave impactful keynotes at the conference. First up was Andrew Griffiths, Director of Community and Partnerships at PlanetMark. He presented on why we need to act now to save our planet. And afterwards, I asked him, why the initial focus on carbon footprint measurement?
I'd ask you to imagine your CFO, your chief financial officer, coming to you and saying, I'd like you to cut money. I'd like you to save some money in our budgets. I don't want you to measure anything. I don't want you to set any targets. I just want you to come up with a list of things you think we could do to save money. And that's what we'll report to our investors, and they'll be really happy, won't they? And the answer to that question is no, of course they wouldn't be. If you don't measure it, you can't manage it. If you don't set a target, you can't progress towards anything. And so third-party certification really allows you to have that credibility in this space, particularly where there's so much confusion and, you know, lots of greenwashing and things going on. By having someone else scrutinize your books in exactly the same way as you do with your financial accounts, you are able to have that credibility out in the space with your customers, with other businesses, and ultimately it sets you on the path to being a more sustainable company.
How can enlisting an external sustainability consultant or auditor add value to that process?
On the 24th of September last year, Tesco sent an email to every single one of their suppliers saying, we need your carbon footprint by the end of the year. We need you to have a net zero target by the end of 2022. We need you to have a science-based target with a 50% reduction in your carbon emissions by 2030, by the end of 2023. And you need to switch to renewable energy now if you haven't already done so. Now, you're either on the risk side of that, where you are going, I need to really rapidly turn this around because I've only got 3 months now to give them a carbon footprint that I haven't started producing yet. Or you're on the opportunity side where you go, here's all of my data. Oh, and by the way, with any of the suppliers who end up dropping off, who can't meet your requirements, let us know because we might be able to fill their shoes.
What are some of the key commercial drivers that you're seeing that are causing companies to embrace measuring and reporting of their carbon reduction or wider sustainability data?
2023 is the deadline for London Stock Exchange listed businesses to have a net zero strategy from the UK government. If you are in the supply chain of any big business, they are coming for your data within the next 12 months. So this wave of responsibility is coming through. And the key thing is that you're either riding that wave on a surfboard or you are drowning.
We then heard from David Hawes, founder of Net Zero International, on measuring your carbon footprint. I asked him, who are the key stakeholders driving the net zero agenda today?
So why is it important? And you'll find it from a couple of reasons more and more. One is because customers are asking for it. Secondly, because suppliers are asking for it. And thirdly, actually, because it'll engage colleagues and staff. So understanding net zero strategy is the first point.
What's become the de facto step-by-step approach to carbon reporting and reduction?
It's the old adage, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So being able to measure what your emissions are and then being able to have a plan to say we're here and we're going to get to there and this is how we're going to get there is vitally important. And I think businesses are sort of doing it, but they're probably not got the measurements in place or the strategy in place yet. And that's what really where we come in and support organisations in that strategy piece.
How does a company take the first step on identifying their carbon emissions?
So the first thing generally with businesses is to measure what we call scope 1 and 2. So they're generally the easier data sets to get. So utility bills, company fuel usage, get that information, use a platform that can then convert that information into carbon emissions and understand what that is, and then start to talk and engage with colleagues, as I said, about how they can improve that. Obviously, using a platform like ours, you know, very user-friendly, and it will help businesses to do that. And then we can offer support and advice as you start to measure other metrics that haven't been measured historically. Businesses over 250 staff have to do that through what's called an SECR. Increasingly, customers are asking their suppliers to do it. It will probably be legislation by the end of 2025. Every business will have to actually publicly show what their carbon is, maybe even by the end of 2024.
And finally, we heard from Rondi Allen and Nick Riley, co-founders of Sustainable X, on practical sustainability for business. I caught up with them after their keynote and asked them what publicly available sources of information can a company consult to draw up their own roadmap for improving sustainability.
So there are a number of frameworks available, and if you Google it, you'll find a bunch of them. Just pick one, whether it's the UN Sustainable Development Goals, whether it's an ESG framework, there's guidance there. Pick it and work out what your biggest impact areas are. What are the big deals for your business? When you know what those big deals are, how can you measure your impacts? And from that point, you can baseline that and start to set targets to move forward.
Could a company benefit from studying what their competitors are doing on this front?
I think this is such a big topic and the pace is so fast that people need to look at their competitors to see what their industry is doing. It's not a bad thing to be copying good practice. So if you can do something that your industry is doing to improve, you might be able to collaborate, you can reduce cost, and the impact is greater for everybody. It's a great topic for customers to talk to industry bodies and any business that wants to move along sustainability topics. We see wins for everybody.
What would be that one key piece of advice you'd give to a company just now considering starting out on the road to achieving net zero carbon?
It's to get started. It can seem as a really difficult topic to crack, but actually break it down, do something. So measure your carbon, measure your waste, and start setting yourself some baseline. Don't wait for a big bang, get going.
Following the keynote speeches, the conference moved into an interactive afternoon of panel sessions focusing on answering questions from the audience on issues covering development, locality, delivery, and what sustainable steps individuals can personally take in contributing to the wider net zero carbon agenda. At the end of the event, later that afternoon, I caught up with the event organisers, Adrian Hawkins and Ian Taylor from Biz for Biz, who shared their thoughts on a successful conference. Ian explained what he felt were the key ingredients in the structure of the event.
I think today was the bringing together of the whole ESG concept. I think we talk about climate change a lot and carbon emissions, but this was all about the future plans to bring into that these social as well as the governance around all of that. And I felt that the holistic approach that we got today was the biggest value.
The inclusion of the panel discussions was well received with some really good questions. How beneficial did Ian think it had been for the delegates?
We had a number of questions ahead of the event, but we had plenty from the floor as well. It gave that opportunity for the delegates to actually just voice what's in their mind, not what we think is in their mind.
I asked Adrian, more widely, what sort of feedback has been forthcoming from delegates on the day, and he shared with me a few examples.
Everybody I've spoken to has said what a great event it's been. It's an opportunity to bring people together and discuss. And I think we've achieved that today. We've been able to impart significant amounts of information about, you know, what everybody's expectations are and how do we go about resolving being sustainable in business. We've provided a lot of people things to think about. I mean, even organisations I've been speaking to today who are halfway through their sustainability journey are starting to realise that there's perhaps a prolongation, if you like, of certain aspects of their business that they need to now start looking into.
I've just had a conversation with one of the delegates who said, thank you so much, I now know what to do, because that was what we aimed to give them.
Right.
He now knows where to go.
Biz for Biz has made an important contribution to the region, providing a forum in which these vital topics can be discussed. How does that fit with Biz for Biz's general role and mission?
Post-COVID, we've actually had a really good event where people have been able to come out and be amongst people again. Rothamsted, Biz for Biz work very closely together. They're a key deliverer of sustainability for many, many years. They have a fantastic facility here. Don't you agree?
I totally agree. I think to be here at the centre of one of Hertfordshire's main research institutes, and also to have the benefit of a very professionally organised venue, creates that vision of what Biz for Biz is.
The objective of Biz for Biz is exactly what it says in the title. Businesses working for the benefit and the future of businesses. Biz4Biz, the voice of business.
Distilling all the insights and takeaways from a full-day event into this half-hour episode was a good challenge, but I hope you were able to get a real flavour of the positivity and opportunities that were evident at the conference. Being able to bring together incredible people who are motivated to take action is a real livener, and it sets the mindset for the important work ahead, which will deliver benefits for the environment and progress for our global society. If you'd like to know more about the speakers, sponsors or organisers, visit the Sustainability Conference page at biz4biz.org. That's B-I-Z, the number 4, B-I-Z.org. If you found this episode interesting, please let us know. You can find me on LinkedIn, on Twitter at GPG Hawkins, or you can email me at podcast@ceoptimist.com. If you'd like to suggest a topic or event for us to cover that's aligned with our themes of inclusive leadership and sustainable business, or you'd like to join us as a future guest on the Chief Executive Optimist, do please get in touch. In our next episode, we'll be delving deeper into the role that forward-thinking leadership plays in companies taking bold action to safeguard the environment for future generations. Until then, remember to live with intention, make choices based on your values, and not let the choices of other people define you.